Simon & Schuster Audio presents The House of My Mother, A Daughter's Quest for Freedom by Sherry Franke, read by the author.
To anybody who has been silenced, gaslit, abused, or lonely, you are stronger than you know. May earthly and heavenly angels lift you up. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to teach me. Song of Solomon, chapter 8, verse 2, New American Standard Bible. Introduction. Finally. August 30th, 2023. It was a Wednesday, the start of a new college year, and I was slumped at my cramped desk, drowning in a sea of syllabi and first-week reading assignments. I skimmed the pages, but my mind refused to engage, thoughts always circling back to my five siblings. A year had passed since I'd heard their voices, seen their faces, and the thought of them trapped in that house was eating me alive. Despite all my efforts, the countless phone calls, the desperate pleas to anyone who would listen, it seemed like there was nothing we could do to remove them from harm's way. My phone rang, our neighbor's name flashing on the screen. My heart skipped a beat. Each call from this neighbor represented a lifeline. It meant an update about the kids. It meant that they were still alive. "Sherry, the police are at your mother's house." The words exploded through the speaker, no time for hello. "They've got guns out. They're about to bust down the door." My heart seized in my chest as vivid, horrifying images flooded my mind. Tiny body bags being carried out of my mother's home by faceless figures in uniforms. "It's happened," came the thought. "They're dead." In a daze, I grabbed my car keys and bolted. The drive from my student apartment to my mother's house in Springville usually took 20 minutes, but today it was an eternity compressed into moments of blind panic. I hadn't been back to that house since Ruby had disowned me a year prior. Ruby, the self-anointed saint of motherhood. Ruby, who had turned my life into a surreal version of the Truman Show for her social media disciples. Ruby, who had subjected me and my siblings to her twisted interpretation of crime and punishment all our lives, until Jody came along, adding terrifying new flavors of sadism to the regime. Jody, our family's very own cult leader, a false prophet who swept into our lives like a hurricane, turning my mother into a fawning, starstruck acolyte who lapped up her every demented word like it was holy water. My father, once our anchor, had been banished, leaving Ruby and Jody to rule unchallenged over my four youngest siblings who were still there with them. I drove through the familiar streets of Springville, a dull, all-too-familiar anger simmering within me as I navigated the quiet of suburbia. Why did no one have any information on the children? Why had they been pulled out of school? Why couldn't anyone shield them from harm? Countless warnings had already been sent to the Division of Child and Family Services, DCFS. To law enforcement, by me, and by concerned neighbors. I'd been shouting from the rooftops for a year. Yet, despite the glaring signs of trouble, no action had been taken. The red flags we'd raised might as well have been invisible, and the system that was supposed to protect my siblings had left them at the mercy of two women drunk on delusion and unchecked power. I turned onto our sleepy cul-de-sac and encountered a war zone. Police cruisers formed a barricade of flashing lights. SWAT teams prowled our front lawn, neighbors huddled on the sidewalks, fear and fascination on their faces. I got out of my car and an officer blocked my path, his face a tombstone. "I can't let you go past this point, miss." "But that's my house," I pleaded. "My siblings, are they safe? Where are they?" Snippets of radio chatter teased me. Was that my brother's name I heard? "Please," I begged, "will someone tell me what's happening?" An officer approached, his tone urgent. "Miss, can you provide us with a layout of the house? Any safes, guns?" Through my tears, I gave him the information he needed. 7 bedrooms, 6 bathrooms, where we once jostled for mirror space. Some guns locked away. A pantry that could outlast an apocalypse. Each room echoing with the ghosts of who we once were. Then chaos erupted. The front door splintered under the battering ram's assault. Officers swarmed in like angry hornets. I stood, rooted to the spot, watching. "God, please, let them be alive," I prayed. A surreal thought bubbled up. This moment, this climax of my family's descent into madness, needed to be documented, preserved, and shared on social media. Just like every forced smile, every staged perfection had been, too. I pulled out my phone, my hands steady despite the madness around me. Frame shot. Snap. The caption crystallized in my mind, a single word that carried the weight of years. Finally. Upload to Instagram. Share. This nightmare was born on social media. It should die there, too. Part 1. The Garden of Earthly Delights. Chapter 1. Sealed. I have a recurring dream. It always starts so beautifully. Ethereal light bathes rolling fields as far as the eye can see. A sense of profound peace washes over me as I realize this must be heaven. My earthly journey has ended. The landscape shifts, familiar yet otherworldly. Loved ones I've lost appear in the distance, their faces radiant. I move toward them, weightless, unburdened, embracing them with tears of joy. This is paradise, I think. This is peace. Then I see those eyes, cold and unyielding, boring into me with a power as ancient as the stars. It's her, Ruby. Suddenly, God's voice booms around me, shaking the very foundations of heaven. My child, you were wrong to defy your mother. I jolt awake, heart pounding, and for a moment the terror lingers. Even in the afterlife, will I never be free from her? My mother was born Ruby Griffiths on January 18, 1982, in Logan, Utah, the first child of five to Chad and Jennifer Griffiths, whose families had been devout members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, LDS, for generations. When Ruby was young, her family relocated to Roy, Utah, a small city where the LDS Church shaped nearly every aspect of life. In this tight-knit community, days revolved around scripture study, clean living, and above all else, family. That is, after all, the cornerstone of our faith. As the eldest in a strict, conservative home, Ruby's childhood was less about play and more about responsibility, and she was tasked with helping to raise her younger siblings. I can easily imagine a young Ruby, spine straight and eyes determined, navigating her family's expectations with a sense of righteous purpose, eagerly anticipating the day when she would have a family of her own, relishing the thought of finally being the one to make the rules and shape her home exactly as she saw fit. For Ruby, motherhood wasn't just a future role. It was the pinnacle of her aspirations, the one thing she had always wanted for herself above all else. Her reverence for motherhood is not uncommon in the LDS theology I was raised with. Becoming a mother, in my faith, is a spiritual calling of the highest order, a chance to emulate the divine and participate in the grand tapestry of creation. Perhaps that's why the physical toll, the discomforts of pregnancy, the searing pain of childbirth, weren't seen as obstacles to be overcome or burdens to be endured by Ruby. Rather, they were sacred trials, opportunities to demonstrate her unwavering faith in God's plan and secure her place in the celestial afterlife alongside the hallowed ancestors who had walked this path before her. As soon as she turned 18, the starting gun went off in Ruby's race toward eternal exaltation, and my mother embarked on her mission to populate not just her earthly home, but her heavenly mansion as well. First, though, she needed a husband. In the year 2000, when 18-year-old Ruby first set foot on the Utah State University campus, she had one thing on her mind: manhunting. Yes, she had chosen accounting as her major, but college was never about learning for Ruby. It was about finding a mate so she could get married, start a family, and begin fulfilling her divine purpose ASAP. On a color-coded vision board, Ruby outlined the key qualities she required in a man: 5 inches taller than me, handsome, car paid off, engineer. Her own father was an engineer, so perhaps she liked the idea of history repeating itself. It goes without saying, her ideal man had to be devoted to the church. Enter my father, Kevin Frankie, a senior living on campus, 4 years older at 22, on the brink of completing his civil engineering degree, and very much a product of his LDS faith. He stood 5 inches taller than Ruby, check, had a chiseled jawline, handsome, double check, and his keen intellect and ambition hinted at a promising future. Plus, he seemed so nice. Exuding genuine kindness, Kevin had a laid-back aura that was a balm to Ruby's intense spirit. Ruby had no interest in power struggles, after all. What she needed was someone relaxed enough to let her take the reins without too much resistance, a co-pilot content to let her navigate their shared journey, pay the bills, and give her the children she longed for. Born on October 9, 1978, in Ogden, Utah, Kevin was the youngest of seven siblings, trailing his nearest brother by a full 12 years. Kevin's late arrival made him something of an anomaly, while his siblings were navigating high school and beyond. He was still learning to tie his shoes, and his days unfolded in a haze of neighborhood adventures and sports on TV, overseen by parents who'd done it all before. Kevin's mom didn't like to cook or bake. Life revolved around pre-made meals, TV, and talk of faith. The household was generally relaxed without a lot of rules, an easygoing environment that sculpted Kevin into a gentle, even-keeled sort of guy. Like Ruby, Kevin was devoted to finding his spiritual partner, a future mother to the children he hoped to raise in the gospel. But he had come to college to learn, secure his future, and had been in no hurry to meet his wife, until he laid eyes on Ruby, that is. He saw her first, working the room at a Welcome Week hot dog social on campus. The undisputed queen bee, Ruby flitted from man to man, her flirtatious confidence unlike anything he'd ever seen before. It helped that she was naturally beautiful, blonde, with a huge dazzling smile and a svelte figure. Ruby was just his type. As she methodically auditioned potential husbands, like a director casting her leading man, Kevin sensed the clock was ticking. Ruby was a prize catch, and if he didn't somehow distinguish himself in the crowd, he'd wind up just another also-ran in Ruby's race to the altar. One evening, Kevin was sitting next to Ruby, holding her hand under a blanket as they watched a movie with some friends. Kevin couldn't care less about what was happening on the screen. All he could think about was the softness of her skin, the gentle pressure of her grip, the occasional brush of her thumb across his knuckles. Each sensation was electric, sending shivers up his arm and straight to his core. Then Kevin glanced over and noticed another guy, one of Ruby's admirers, sitting way too close on her other side. His stomach dropped as he realized Ruby was holding this guy's hand under the blanket, too. Usually so level-headed, Kevin jumped up, his face burning, heart racing. Without a word, he stormed out, leaving Ruby gaping after him. The next day, Kevin talked to Ruby and laid down the law. No more hand-holding with other guys, period. Ruby, attracted to his passion for her, fast-tracked Kevin to meet the Griffiths, her parents and toughest critics. They approved, and Kevin, in turn, introduced Ruby to his parents, the Frankies, who thought Ruby seemed like a lovely young lady, perfect for their son. 2 weeks after the day they met, Ruby cut to the chase. "So, are we getting married?" she asked. Kevin, caught off guard, uttered the most dangerous word in the dictionary: "Yes." In just 14 days, they had gone from strangers to engaged. As Ruby and Kevin threw themselves into wedding planning, they got to know each other a little more. Turned out they both loved playing the piano, though their approaches to the instrument could not have been more different. Kevin had a photographic memory and could play jazz numbers and popular songs without even practicing. Ruby, on the other hand, had once poured her entire being into the piano. Throughout her teens, she'd immersed herself in the world of classical music, her dreams filled with visions of concert halls and standing ovations. She approached each piece with meticulous precision, spending hours perfecting every note, every dynamic shift. For her, playing wasn't about fun, it was about excelling, and when she fell short of perfection, it left a dent in her ego that no amount of practice seemed to fill. Ruby's entire self-worth was built on exceptionalism, so if she couldn't be extraordinary, then what was the point? She needed a new dream, a fresh source of validation. If music wouldn't define her greatness, then motherhood would. Cherubic faces to beam up at her with the love and adoration she craved. Blank slates ready to be inscribed with her wisdom, her values, her Rubiness. A couple of kids would have suited Kevin fine, but Ruby craved a clan, and Kevin was happy to agree to Ruby's grand vision, vowing to move heaven and earth to support her in her dreams. Thus, the dynamic was set. Kevin, the perpetual supporting actor to Ruby's lead role in her epic production of Ultimate Mother. On December 28, 2000, barely 3 months after their first meeting, Ruby and Kevin strode toward the temple, ready to be eternally sealed in the eyes of God. Ruby was a vision in ivory, her hair a cascade of curls, a southwestern blanket draped over her shoulders against the winter chill. Even Kevin's mismatched shoes, one black, one brown, thanks to rush dressing in the dark, couldn't dim her smile. This was it, Ruby's fairytale moment come to life. As the vows left her lips, she felt her happily ever after unfurling before her like a red carpet. Finally, her life was about to begin. Chapter 2. Teardrops. "She's getting tired in there," the obstetrician said. "We'll need to do an assisted delivery." Then, with a contraption that looked better suited to cleaning carpets than guiding new life, the doctor suctioned my head and forcibly pulled me out into the world. It was March 3, 2003, and after 9 difficult months of pregnancy filled with a slew of medical complications, 21-year-old Ruby had finally evicted me, her first baby, from her womb. Somehow, through her fog of pain and exhaustion, Ruby managed a victorious smile. In her arms lay not just a baby, but a woman's ultimate power, her divine right to mold a new soul in her own image. Cradling me in the exhausted aftermath of delivery, she looked past the squalling, writhing bundle in her arms to the exalted future I represented. In my tiny frame, Ruby saw the first brushstrokes of her magnum opus, Chapter 1, in the epic narrative that would be her legacy of unparalleled parenting prowess. When I was around 3 months, Ruby took me to the pediatrician to find out why I was so grouchy. My constant wailing was testing her vision of motherly bliss, but the doctor said it was just colic. When I began refusing my bottles and growing lethargic, Kevin freaked out, rushing me to the emergency room, where they discovered that I had a life-threatening intestinal blockage. Without the immediate surgery I received, I most likely would have died. From the very start, it seemed, my childhood was destined to be a fight for survival. Ruby didn't believe in comforting me when I was a baby, not in the way most parents do. Why would she? Her family's philosophy had always been that it doesn't hurt a baby to cry things out. Babies shouldn't be coddled. Tantrums should not be tolerated. It's for their own good, so they know who's boss, and when they grow up, they can learn to handle whatever life throws at them without being weak losers or crybabies. Yet, ironically, my earliest memories are of Ruby crying. She had tears for every occasion. Joy, sorrow, boredom, it didn't matter. Ruby wept through it all. A woman perpetually at odds with her own equilibrium. Perhaps that's why she wanted so many children. A set of Russian nesting dolls, each one a slightly smaller version of the last, to absorb the tsunami of her raging emotions. For what better way to fill the gaping void within than to surround yourself with adoring little mini-me's? Interesting, though, how someone who cried so much herself seemed entirely immune to the tears of others, including mine. I often wonder how much of my adult self was forged in those early formative years. My tendency to bottle up emotions, to present a stoic face to the world, are these echoes of an infant learning that her distress will always go unheeded? Even before I could form words or thoughts, was I learning that my pain didn't matter? That my needs were inconvenient? If my tears had been met with comfort instead of calculated indifference, would I have grown into someone more open, less guarded? Or was I always destined to retreat inward, become emotionally distant at a moment's notice, my feelings trapped behind a fortress that I still struggle to breach? There's no way to know for sure. Nature and nurture dance a complex tango, after all. But as I reflect on the many incongruities of my childhood, I can't help but feel sadness for the baby girl who cried for her mother, who wanted a different kind of love than the kind she received, a love that allows for vulnerability, for tears, for the full range of human emotion, a love that allows a child the freedom to feel. Chapter 3. Mommy isn't very nice to me. In 2005, when I was 2, The Ruby Show expanded its cast with my brother Chad's debut. Alongside him, another addition, our first dog, Nolly, a bouncing yellow Labrador puppy full of energy and love. She'd bound up to me, tail wagging furiously, showering me with sloppy kisses. Nolly, much like my little brother, would never fail to make me laugh. In 2007, Ruby's third child, a girl, arrived on the scene. I will not be naming her in this audiobook. Throughout this narrative, except for Chad, all my younger siblings will remain nameless. This isn't an oversight. It's my last line of defense for them. In a kinder world, their stories would not be fodder for a book. Their private moments would be their own, known only to friends and family, not dissected by strangers on the internet. But peace and anonymity were never in the cards for us. We have Ruby to thank for that. Ruby and her insatiable hunger for attention and success. My mother's journey into the spotlight started innocently enough, a mommy blog titled Good Lookin' Home Cookin'. Mommy blogging was still a wild frontier then, ripe for the taking, and Ruby, like her sisters and friends, was excited to explore the possibilities of online media. My main goal for this blog is to journal our family's growth and experiences, Ruby proclaimed on her shiny new blogger profile. I want my children to have a place on the internet to go and enjoy reading about themselves and to see how they've progressed. In my church, we're encouraged to document our lives meticulously, creating a roadmap for future generations to understand their roots. And it seemed as though the internet was just an extension of that, another way in which to do the Lord's work. Her little recipe-filled blog gave Ruby her first taste of online existence and the possibilities it held, as a tool for self-expression, a way to project an identity and forge a connection with people by sharing her recipes for raspberry butter, honey lime chicken, and trail mix cookies, painting a picture of a home filled with the constant aroma of freshly baked bread and lovingly prepared meals. The truth is, I'm not sure she ever made those dishes. Sure, Ruby was always baking something. She enjoyed trying out recipes from her Ann Romney cookbook, but most of the recipes on Good Lookin' Home Cookin' were aspirational rather than realistic. Part of an image, that of the smiling, flower-smudged mama, the gaggle of cherubs gathered around the table. Even at this early stage of her online career, Ruby was showing her willingness to sacrifice authenticity on the altar of appearances. There are some exceptions. I can confirm that her bread was legendary, a staple of every family gathering and potluck. She'd slice it thick, each piece a small loaf in itself, with uneven air pockets that spoke of hand-kneading and patience. The crust always had a slight crackle, giving way to a soft, warm interior. It was the kind of bread that demanded to be noticed, that turned a simple sandwich into a meal. One slice was often enough to fill me up, though I'd usually end up eating more. She went on to start other blogs, Full Suburban, and a mommy blogging group with her friends called Yummy Mummies. Exercising her natural flair for marketing, she started branding our family photos, putting a logo in the corner saying, "It's a Frankie life." My three aunts, Ellie, Bonnie, and Julie, who had all settled within an hour and a half's drive of one another with their husbands and own growing broods, showed similar interests in blogging. It seemed embedded in the Griffiths' DNA, this feminine urge to take family life and turn it into something bigger. "All my kids are going to learn how to play the piano," Ruby proclaimed, "and as the firstborn, I got to be the guinea pig." From the age of 5, Ruby would wake me up at 6 a.m. and plonk me in front of our kawaii upright to practice under her exacting gaze. "Curve your fingers, Sherry, count it out," she'd bark, slamming the piano with her hand, making me jump. "And for heaven's sake, don't give me that face." I quickly learned that anything less than unbridled enthusiasm would trigger Ruby into a rage. One hint of displeasure on my face, and whack. A smack on my arm, a flick to my lips, or a sharp tug on my ear. I rarely cried when Ruby punished me. Only one person in this house was allowed to shed tears, and it wasn't me. So I kept quiet, maintained a neutral expression. But beneath that calm exterior, a realization was taking root. Mommy isn't very nice to me. I was grateful for Nolly, who'd grown from an adorable puppy into a full-grown Labrador. During those grueling piano practice sessions, when Mom's critical voice seemed to fill every corner of the room, Nolly would position herself under the piano, her warm body pressed against my feet. When Mom's tirade became too much, I'd glance down to see Nolly's gentle brown eyes gazing up at me, full of love and reassurance, as if to say, "It's okay, we're in this together." "Mommy," I'd whimper, padding into my parents' room late at night, my stuffed horse bubbles clutched to my chest. "My tummy hurts again." Ruby would sigh heavily, her face pinched with annoyance. "Sherry, we've been through this. There's nothing wrong with you. Go back to bed." Even then, at 5 years old, my body was beginning to rebel, as if my very cells were crying out in protest against the environment in which they found themselves. I know now, of course, that the pain in my stomach was more than just a childish complaint. It was a physical response to my anxiety. At night, that constant sense of unease would transform into something frightening. I would lie in bed, feeling the darkness press on me, utterly convinced that at any moment, a real-life demon would materialize beside me in my bed, ready to steal my soul. The fear was so real, I would plead with Ruby to leave the light on when I went to bed, but she had no time for my antics. "No, Sherry, you need to learn to sleep in the dark. There are no demons in my house." She was wrong, of course. There was certainly one. And as soon as the lights went out, others would appear, grotesque figures straight out of a medieval hellscape, demonic entities leering with twisted grins. Their contorted faces haunted my sleepless nights, their agonized stories playing out in my dreams. Why might a little girl harbor such tangible fears of demonic possession? I'm sure the deeply religious paradigm I was steeped in played a role. We firmly believe in Satan's power and the ability of his legion of fallen spirits to possess individuals. We believe that evil can inhabit physical forms, sometimes fleetingly, sometimes for extended periods. Having been raised to believe the very air I breathed was thick with unseen forces battling for dominion over my soul, it was a small step for my young mind to imagine that battle raging in my own bedroom. Perhaps, too, my constant sense of dread around my emotionally volatile mother had primed me for such fears, as if my subconscious, unable to make sense of the chaos at home, had conjured supernatural terrors to give shape to the formless anxiety that seemed to permeate our home. One week, I practiced a new song my piano teacher had assigned, drilling each note and chord until I could practically play it in my sleep. Ruby seemed pleased with my progress and decided it was time to move on to another piece of music. But then came my piano lesson. "Not quite there yet, sweetie," said the teacher after hearing me play. "Let's work on it for one more week." One more week before she'd give me a sticker, passing it off as complete, which doubtless seemed like a small thing to her. What she didn't realize was that little gold star represented life or death to me. How was I supposed to tell Ruby that her judgment had been overruled? Did my teacher not understand the precarious position in which she had placed me, the delicate balance of power she had just upset? Hot tears pricked the corners of my eyes, and I squirmed in my seat as my teacher looked at me quizzically, unused to seeing such intense reactions from a 5-year-old. "What's the matter, Sherry?" she asked. "It's just, my mom thinks it's ready," I said, voice quavering. How could I possibly explain to my teacher the minefield I was navigating daily? The eggshells upon eggshells that I was forced to tread. My teacher, sensing that Pandora's box had just opened, chose wisely to shut it. "Okay, never mind. Here's a sticker. Well done. You're doing great. New piece next week?" Phew, I was out of the quicksand. For now. Looking back, I marvel at how quickly my young mind adapted to Ruby's moods. At 5, I knew my place instinctively. Be pliable. Be obedient. Shape and mold myself into whatever form would earn Ruby's conditional affection. I was a plant straining for the sun, contorting myself into unnatural shapes just to catch a ray of her approval. But no matter how much I twisted and turned, no matter how much I achieved or accomplished, it would never be enough. There would always be some new hoop to jump through, some new standard to meet. No child should ever have to earn a parent's affection, and no amount of achievement can ever fill the void where unconditional love should be. Today, the mere thought of sitting at a piano triggers some of my earliest and deepest anxieties, all tied to my mother. It's a shame how the most beautiful things, even music, can be ruined by the shadows of our past. Chapter 4: The Rage Inside. When I was 6 years old in 2009, Ruby gave birth to baby number 4, another girl. My 3 aunts and their husbands were all present at the delivery, and as the story went, my sister just popped out very fast as though she were excited to be a part of the party. The day Ruby came home from the hospital, I remember hovering in the doorway of her bedroom, watching as Ruby's mother presented her with a gift, a set of beautiful silk pajamas. As I stood there, taking in the scene, I couldn't help but feel a pang of something I couldn't quite name. Jealousy? Longing? Ruby and her mother shared a bond that seemed impenetrable, a closeness I both admired and envied. Their easy laughter and shared smiles made me feel even more aware of the distance between Ruby and me. I blurted out, "Will you bring me silk pajamas too when I have a baby?" "Absolutely," Ruby said, her voice light. "When you have a baby, that's when we can be friends." In that instant, everything clicked into place. The distance I'd always felt, the longing for a closer relationship with my mother, it all made sense. Ruby and I couldn't be real friends until I was a woman with a husband and a family of my own, until I was her equal. Just as Ruby had to become a wife and mother to truly earn her own mother's respect, I too would have to do the same. I would have to wait to be loved. As I watched Ruby and her mother coo over the silk pajamas, I made a silent vow to myself. One day, I will have a baby of my own. One day, I will receive my own set of pajamas. And on that day, finally, Ruby and I will be friends. Ruby started trying for her next baby immediately, even though it was obvious the stress of the constant pregnancies was getting to her. There were days her eyes would narrow to slits, her lips pressed into a thin, bloodless line as she observed the chaos of a house filling up with tiny humans. She'd survey our home with the cold calculation of a general assessing a battlefield, deciding how to impose order. Her weapon of choice? Her voice, sometimes her hands. Whoever was nearest bore the brunt of her frustration. A toppled vase, a stray toy, the glass bearing the faintest smudge, all became excuses for her assaults. As soon as her children could toddle, Ruby enlisted us as her pint-sized cleaning crew. Ruby's philosophy was simple. Everyone contributes, everyone stays busy. Idle hands were the devil's playground, after all. One of her favorite tactics was the cleaning blitz. She'd gather us all with a glint in her eye and announce, "All right, troops, I'm setting the timer for 1 hour. We're going to clean this house from top to bottom. Ready, set, go." We'd all scatter, a whirlwind of dusting, scrubbing, and tidying. It was chaotic, exhausting, and weirdly exhilarating. I didn't mind being mommy's little helper, taking charge of my siblings to assist in our increasingly demanding domestic life. Money was very tight, but Kevin's career as a geotechnical engineer was on the rise. He was genuinely fascinated by plate tectonics and earth liquefaction, immersing himself in an academic world where changes happened on a geological timescale. It was a stark contrast to the daily kitchen sink dramas that consumed Ruby's psyche, the emotional meltdowns that left us all walking on eggshells. One day, something shifted in Ruby. Her ever-present tears took on a new weight, and even with my limited understanding, I sensed something very sad had occurred. Ruby had suffered another miscarriage, her third, at 17 weeks. The pregnancy was far enough along that she had felt those first fluttering kicks, knew the gender, a boy, and had even chosen a name. This time, it wasn't just losing a pregnancy. It felt like losing a son, a piece of herself. Ruby never allowed herself time to grieve. She'd been taught that when life gets tough, you pull up your bootstraps and keep going. Keep having more babies, keep baking bread, keep bustling around. One night, she had a dream she was grocery shopping and saw a little boy standing alone by the apples. She asked him where his mommy was. He told her he didn't have one. "Would you like to come home with me?" she said. "I could be your mommy." He nodded his head, and Ruby put him in the cart on top of the bread and bananas. A month later, she was pregnant. As soon as Ruby's belly began to swell with her fifth child, a rare, fleeting calm washed over her. Pregnancy, for her, remained the highest calling, a sacred connection to her divine purpose. In those moments of quiet contemplation, when Ruby's hand rested gently on her growing bump, I saw glimpses of her at her most peaceful and fulfilled. How I longed to taste that same sense of purpose, to embark on my own spiritual journey and discover the true meaning of life. Chapter 5. Pioneers. When I was 8 years old, we moved into our first detached family home. Finally, a swing set in the yard. I spent countless hours on those swings, pumping my legs and imagining I could touch the sky. Ruby, in her enthusiasm for a fresh start, immediately set about painting the walls and doors various shades of yellow, her favorite color. "Mommy," I once asked, "why does everything have to be so bright?" The garish hue was overwhelming, making every room feel loud and chaotic. She just beamed at me, clearly proud of her handiwork. "It's cheerful. Don't you feel happy looking at it?" I didn't have the heart to tell her that it mostly made me feel like I was trapped inside a giant banana. Our house was in Springville, a flat, sprawling settlement of around 10,000 people, founded in 1850 by LDS pioneers. Springville is nestled at the foot of the Wasatch Mountains. Those mountains marked the edge of the world to me for the longest time. If you're after fine dining and high culture, you might be disappointed by Springville's offerings. We have a Walmart, a neighborhood grocery store, a couple Taco Bells, and an IHOP. That's about it. For more interesting entertainment options, people make the 15-minute drive to Provo or Spanish Fork. Springville doesn't have its own temple, so many residents drive to the Provo Temple to worship. It used to look like a wedding cake spaceship, an oval with a spire that resembled a UFO, but they've since added a more conventional red brick building. For the classic white LDS temple experience, it's an hour and a half drive north to the awe-inspiring Salt Lake Temple in Salt Lake City, its tallest central eastern spire crowned by the golden statue of the angel Moroni. I remember how the nerves fluttered in my stomach as I stepped into the baptismal font, the water lapping at my ankles through the lace of my white jumpsuit. I was 8 years old and about to officially take my first significant steps into my LDS faith through baptism. As I was submerged beneath the surface, I felt a rush of peace. I was safe now, protected by God and my faith, no matter what else happened around me. For what were Ruby's tantrums and tirades compared to the eternal truths of the gospel? Baptism felt like safety, security, and warmth, and I clung to that feeling like a lifeline, writing in my journal how being baptized felt like a warm waffle had been laid on top of me. Around this time, Ruby felt I was old enough to have the talk about the birds and the bees. The front porch of our new home was a setting, and I don't remember exactly what prompted the discussion. Maybe I had asked an innocent question about babies, but I do recall struggling to process this new and frankly disturbing information. I asked Ruby how long it had to stay in for a girl to get pregnant. Her vague answer, some arbitrary number, only added to my bewilderment. In my young mind, I imagined couples setting timers, treating the act with the same clinical detachment as baking a cake. Plug it in for 30 seconds, and voila, a baby is on the way. My worldview shifted dramatically as suddenly every adult I saw became a participant in this bizarre ritual. Our neighbor, taking out his garbage, had done this strange act. When our bishop drove by with his kids, I was mortified. Oh my gosh, my bishop too? The idea that these respectable adults, pillars of our community, engaged in such an act was almost too much to bear. I was left with a sense of disgust and confusion, viewing sex as a weird, slightly gross thing that adults obviously did out of duty to God rather than desire. In my family, it's a tradition to mark a child's baptism with a gift of their first set of scriptures. Mine was bound in rich leather, my name embossed in gold on the cover. Though the language within those pages often eluded me, I spent hours poring over each verse, highlighting favorite passages in a rainbow of colors. As soon as I began to learn about the story of Joseph Smith, the prophet and founder of our church, my fascination with my religion spilled over into obsession. I loved the swashbuckling character who dared to challenge the religious establishment of his day back in the 1830s. I was captivated by the stories of his treasure-hunting adventures transformed into holy quests, how his trances and visions gave rise to a whole new religion. Most little girls are into Disney, dolls, and cartoons, and I liked those things too. But for me, the story of Joseph Smith and the golden plates was right up there with Frozen. It helped that he wasn't some distant figure from the pages of ancient history or an Old Testament saint from a far-off land. He was kind of like us, a regular American from regular beginnings. And I loved that his story hadn't happened all that long ago, taking place recently enough that my blood ancestors, like the Widow of Nauvoo, might have been his friend. The Widow of Nauvoo, an early ancestor on my mother's side of the family, lived in Nauvoo, Illinois in the 1840s during the persecution of the LDS congregations. When a mob gathered to burn her house unless she denounced her faith, she stared them down, fearless. "Burn it and be damned," she declared. Growing up, I had heard the story countless times. It was a sacred family legend. Some days I'd look out the window and daydream, imagining the Widow of Nauvoo walking this very same terrain as she journeyed west to start anew. She could feel the grit underfoot, the sun on her back, as she dreamed of a future where she could finally be free from the horrors of her past. "Sherry, come set the table for dinner." Ugh, I hated it when Ruby interrupted my spiritual reveries to make me do chores. As I arranged the plates and napkins with practiced precision, my mind lingered on thoughts of the widow, standing tall before a crowd of skeptics, her eyes blazing with a fire of conviction. In my mind's eye, I was right there beside her. Sometimes those moments felt more real to me than anything in the world around me. "No, no, the forks go on the left. How many times do I have to tell you?" Ruby tutted disapprovingly, my youngest brother, still just a baby, resting on her hip. Kevin's eyes flickered to mine with a sympathetic glimmer. I'd always felt a strong kinship with him, like we were shipmates sailing stormy waters side by side. There was a stoicism to him, a quiet strength that I couldn't help but admire. Kevin might not have been a visionary like Joseph Smith or an iconoclast like the Widow of Nauvoo, but in his own way, he was a hero too. A man who had taken on the thankless task of being the nice guy in our family. As my mother fussed over dessert, cursing under her breath, I sat on my father's lap, full of questions as always. "Dad, why do we have to pay tithing?" I asked, having just learned that everyone in my faith gives 10% of their income to the church. "Doesn't God have enough money already?" Kevin chuckled and tousled my hair. "It's not about God having enough money, sweetie. Tithing is an ancient principle that goes back thousands of years. We give 1/10 of what we earn back to him as an offering to show our gratitude and obedience." "But what does the church do with all that money?" I pressed. "Well, the money goes to build temples and churches and to fund missionary work around the world. But tithing is about more than just giving money. It's a covenant, which means a special promise we make with God. By giving a portion of what we have to him, we show that we trust him to take care of us in return." I thought about this for a moment, trying to wrap my young mind around the concept. "So it's like sharing our stuff with God, and then he shares his blessings with us?" "Exactly," Kevin smiled. "When we keep our promises to God, he blesses us in ways we can't even imagine." I nodded, feeling a sense of pride in being part of something so important. "I want to be tithing too, Dad. When I'm older and have my own money, I'm going to give 1/10 back to God, just like you do." Ruby, who had been listening quietly, chimed in. "That's right, Sherry. A woman's first duty is to her husband and family. But if she makes money on top of that, God is especially happy when she pays her tithing. It shows that she's putting God first, even in her financial affairs." I looked up at my mother, surprised and pleased by her approval. It felt good to know that there were so many ways a girl could be a faithful servant of the Lord, not just by being a dutiful wife and mother, by contributing financially to the church as well. "Do you wish you could make lots of money too to give to God?" I asked Ruby, my eyes wide with curiosity. Ruby rolled her eyes. "Sure, if you kids weren't so much work. Do you know how exhausting it is being your mom? But being a mother is a divine calling, and I know that by raising you in the faith, I'm doing God's work too. And that's reward enough." As she spoke, I couldn't help but think about my aunts, who had started filming themselves with janky cameras, putting videos on the internet, and making money out of it. We'd watched some of the videos together, and I wondered what it would look like if my mom started filming herself for YouTube too, like them. "No," I thought, "she probably wouldn't want people to see how angry she is all the time." Chapter 6. Ruby's Rage. Ruby was always angry with us, constantly on edge, primed to blow no matter how small the irritation. I probably could have handled her blustering if it weren't for the edge of cruelty that so often colored her rages. I remember being in the bathroom, experimenting with my kids' makeup palette. I must have been around 9 years old, and like many young girls, testing the waters of cosmetics, my attempts were far from subtle. Think bold red lipstick, metallic eyeshadow that could signal planes, and foundation that bore little relation to my actual skin tone. I was a riot of clashing colors and misplaced enthusiasm. Ruby called me downstairs to the piano to practice a duet, one she loved to perform. This duet required a singing partner, and that role inevitably fell to me. I always dreaded these impromptu concerts, feeling like an unwilling actress thrust onto a stage I never asked to occupy. Reluctantly, I descended the stairs, my face a wild rainbow, and grudgingly took my place at the piano. I played the notes mechanically, but I couldn't bring myself to sing. "Sherry, why on earth aren't you singing?" she snapped, her fingers stabbing at the keys. "I don't know, Mom." My voice was barely a whisper. "Maybe you have so much makeup on your face that you've forgotten how to listen to your mother," she said, her voice dripping with disdain. "Perhaps I should smack it all off." Ruby's hand would often find its way to my face, a sharp sting of displeasure delivered with precision. Her slaps were calibrated, never hard enough to leave visible bruises, at least on me, but always sufficient to instill fear. In her twisted logic, she was molding obedience, sculpting compliance with each stinging blow. I also think we were just her punching bag, a way for her to release her anger. She always seemed calmer once she'd blown off steam on one of us. One day, I was sitting cross-legged on my bedroom floor, engrossed in a book, when I felt a sharp tug at the back of my head, followed by a faint snipping sound. Startled, I whirled around just in time to see Chad, my impish 7-year-old brother, darting past, a pair of scissors clutched in his hand and a mischievous grin on his face. My hand flew to the back of my head, where a small clump of hair was now conspicuously missing. Uh-oh. Chad, I yelled, leaping to my feet and chasing after him. What did you do? But he was gone, his laughter echoing down the hallway as he made his escape. Chad was already showing a tendency for pranking and clowning behavior, as many little boys are wont to do. He seemed to delight in causing mischief and mayhem, and was always looking for new ways to get a rise out of people. I returned to my room, assessing the damage in the mirror. I knew there would be hell to pay. Ruby was obsessed with my thick, long brown hair, and had forbidden me from ever cutting or altering it in any way. She always said that one day, men would want to marry me just because of my beautiful locks. Suddenly, Ruby stormed in, holding a small clump of my hair. How could you do this to yourself? I didn't. Chad did it when I wasn't looking. Rage crackled around her like electricity. He was just playing a joke. You can't even tell it's gone, see? I said, attempting to defuse the situation. But Ruby was having none of it. Chad, come here, Ruby yelled, her voice ringing through the house. I winced. Chad was in for it now. As I watched my little brother slink into the room, his eyes wide with trepidation, I felt a surge of protectiveness. Yes, he could be a little terror at times, but he was still my brother, and I hated seeing him bear the brunt of Ruby's anger. What were you thinking, cutting your sister's hair like that? Ruby demanded, her voice icy. Chad shuffled his feet, looking down at the ground. I don't know, he shrugged, his lower lip trembling. I stepped forward, trying to intervene. Mom, it's not a big deal. It'll grow back. But Ruby ignored me, her attention focused solely on Chad. Come on, buddy, let's go to the bathroom. Time for you to have a little haircut, too. I watched, frozen, as Ruby marched Chad down the hallway, her hand clamped tight around his arm. A moment later, the buzz of electric clippers. I held my breath, straining to hear any hint of what was happening. Then the bathroom door swung open, and Chad shuffled out, his head hung low. Ruby had buzzed a thick, uneven stripe down the center of his head, leaving him with a harsh reverse mohawk. Tufts of hair stuck out at odd angles, making him look like a plucked chicken. There, Ruby said, satisfied with her work. Maybe next time you'll think twice before you decide to play barber. She looked to me, her eyes hard. And let that be a lesson to you too, Sherry. In this house, we don't make excuses for other people's bad behavior. I nodded mutely, my throat too tight to speak. When Ruby went downstairs, I gathered my brother into my arms, stroking his ragged hair. I'm sorry, Chad, I whispered, feeling a crushing sense of guilt. Chapter 7. Refuge. I was 11, at the threshold of adolescence, my body and mind beginning to change in ways I didn't fully understand yet. Meanwhile, Ruby was pregnant with her sixth and final child, another girl, and our already full household was adjusting to the idea of yet another sibling joining our ranks. Our routine was fully established by now. We'd all wake up around 6 or 6:30 a.m. when the house came alive with the sound of piano, violin, or harp practice. Then we'd converge in the kitchen where Ruby would whip up oatmeal or eggs. Sometimes we'd squeeze in some scripture study over breakfast, since evenings were usually busy with everyone's after-school activities. Next, we'd pack our own school lunches, a daily exercise in responsibility and self-reliance. I remember watching my siblings standing on tiptoes, barely tall enough to reach the counter, carefully assembling sandwiches and selecting fruits. This is how you become a capable adult, Ruby would say. Then we'd head off to class. Ruby never drove us. Getting to school was another daily exercise and independence that she insisted would build character. Because of our ages, we weren't always at the same school, so our commutes varied. Some of us took the bus, a rumbling yellow behemoth that swallowed us up each morning and spat us out again in the afternoon. For me, at that point in my life, it was a walk. About a mile, a distance that seemed to stretch endlessly before me on those bitterly cold Utah mornings when the wind cut right through my coat. I'd power walk, sometimes breaking into a run, my backpack thumping against my spine. Birthdays were special, though. That's when Ruby would treat us with a ride home from school. The excitement of seeing her car in the pickup line, knowing I wouldn't have to make that long walk home, was better than any wrapped gift. It was a glimpse of the mother I longed for every day. Attentive, interested, present. We rarely had friends over at the house. It wasn't that we were explicitly forbidden from inviting friends into our home, but rather that our house seemed to repel social gatherings by its very nature. The cramped spaces, the constant presence of siblings, and Ruby's perpetual state of stress created an atmosphere that seemed to naturally discourage visitors. Most of my siblings found a middle ground, forming friendships with neighborhood kids and playing outside. This outdoor socializing seemed safer somehow, less intrusive than bringing outsiders into the complex dynamics of our household. For me, the very idea of inviting friends over felt foreign and uncomfortable. It wasn't that I lacked friends entirely, but rather that the thought of merging my school life with my home life filled me with a sense of dread I couldn't quite articulate. After school, family dinners were important to us, though they became more challenging to coordinate as we got older. Homework was usually done at the kitchen table in our old house, since our bedrooms were too small for desks. There wasn't much time for TV, and a lot of content wasn't deemed appropriate for us to watch. To this day, I often feel out of the loop with certain pop culture references. But I was allowed to watch SpongeBob SquarePants and The Simpsons, both of which I loved. And we did love watching movies together as a family. That became our family's default mode of dealing with tension or seeking comfort. We'd gather in the living room, the flickering light of the TV casting a soft glow on our faces, and for a couple of hours, we'd feel at peace. Frozen, and the Harry Potter films in particular, were our favorites. I loved Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, the fifth movie in the series. There was something exotic about the hidden corners of London, the secretive nature of the Order's headquarters, but it was the story of Professor Dolores Umbridge that I enjoyed most for some reason. The tyrannical, power-hungry, condescending, sanctimonious sadist who ultimately faces her comeuppance. Ruby, too, had her favorite Harry Potter moment, though hers came from Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. A scene where Dumbledore, challenged about performing restricted magic within Hogwarts, simply responds, "Being me has its privileges." Ruby would quote this line often with a glimmer in her eye. The idea of being above the rules clearly resonated with my mother. It was during this time of awkward adolescence that I developed a new habit, picking at my lips until they bled. This nervous tic seemed to emerge from nowhere, yet quickly became a constant in my daily life. I would catch sight of myself in the mirror, noticing the small scabs on my lips. I tried to hide the marks, knowing the sight of them would trigger Ruby's anger. "Look at your face, Sherry," she'd scold. "You have to stop. No man is ever going to want to marry you with a bunch of ugly scars all over your lips." At night, I prayed for unblemished skin, a pretty face, all the things I needed to be for my future husband. Still, whether it was hormones or just the cumulative anxiety caused by living with Ruby, my anxiety seemed to be spiraling like never before. I needed an outlet, some way to express my feelings. That's when I started to really lean into my practice of nightly journaling. Record keeping is deeply ingrained in the LDS faith. It's a sacred duty, a way of bearing witness to God's hand in our daily lives. We're taught that our personal histories will serve as testaments for future generations, spiritual roadmaps guiding our descendants through their own mortal journeys. Every night, without fail, Ruby would make her rounds with a reminder. "Did you write about what we did today? Don't forget to mention that funny thing your brother said." We all responded to this nightly ritual with varying levels of enthusiasm. I was definitely the most consistent writer among my siblings. In those quiet moments before sleep, hunched over my journal by the dim glow of a reading lamp, I could be me. On the page, I could express my anxieties and frustrations with my parents, ponder the pressures of being a teenager, and wonder about all these new feelings I was having about boys. Journal. Mom and Dad pulled me into their room tonight. They said that all of my friend problems in school were my fault. They said I'm not a fun person to be around and nobody gets me, which may be true. Then they said it seems like I try on purpose to annoy my family. But the truth is, I just don't enjoy being around them. Ruby and Kevin are the ones who annoy me. I finally got invited to a popular's party. It's super hard to get invited, so I was excited. And I thought Mom and Dad would be pleased because they're always saying I don't have enough friends. Instead, they said I can't go to the party if there are going to be boys there, which means I'll have to stay home. I'm so mad. Can't they see I'm growing up? I'm not their baby girl anymore. I can manage myself. I'm so mad at Mom sometimes. Whenever she helps me practice piano, she promises not to yell. But by the time we are done, she's screaming at the top of her lungs. She is so stressed, uptight, and strict that it's impossible to have fun or relax when she's around. Dad, on the other hand, is loose, easygoing, and handles stress very well. One thing's for sure, I am a daddy's girl. Mom has become obsessed with this place called West Point Military Academy, which means she now punishes us by making us conditioned like soldiers. For example, earlier today she got mad at Chad and me for not putting away the clothes, so she punished us by making us run around the block 5 times. Then at dinner, Chad was hiding and refusing to help me clear the table, so Ruby made us both do push-ups. Chad for shirking his responsibilities, me for not being enough of a leader. I yearned for my mother's guidance, her support, her friendship during this insecure time of puberty. But Ruby maintained a strict emotional distance, as if affection might somehow compromise her authority. "Remember, I'm not your friend, I'm your mother," she'd say whenever I asked her why we couldn't do things, like go to lunch together, like I saw my friends doing with their moms. "My job is to train you how to be ready for the world. When you're an adult, we can be friends." Eventually, I gave up on the idea of being close to Ruby and just saved my feelings for my diary. In this emotional desert, I did find additional solace in the worlds of literature and history. Charles Dickens, Jane Austen, and Dostoevsky. Authors became my companions, offering insights into life, family, and love that I knew I couldn't get from my mother. While fiction offered an escape, a chance to live a thousand lives between the covers of books, it was nonfiction that truly captured my heart and mind. History, in particular, became my obsession, and the Second World War. In middle school, I read more than 100 books on World War II. My teacher ended up having me teach that section of history because I knew more than he did. As I delved into stories of courage and resilience during humanity's darkest hours, like Anne Frank's diary, my own struggles began to shift into perspective. The hardships faced by those who lived through the war, the fear, the loss, the unimaginable choices, made my own challenges seem more manageable, if not insignificant. And that was comforting, in a way. One day, I walked into my history class clutching my latest library find, a thick, worn volume on the rise and fall of the Third Reich. As I slid into my seat, my friend eyed the book with a mixture of curiosity and disbelief. She wrinkled her nose. "Isn't that kind of a heavy topic, Sherry?" "Yeah, it is heavy," I admitted, running my hand over the book's worn spine. "But the Nazi rise in Europe is really important for us to study. Don't you want to know about the suffering and cruelty of the Holocaust? The millions of lives extinguished in the name of Aryan supremacy?" As the words left my mouth, I realized how intense I must have sounded. My friend's expression softened, but I could see the discomfort lingering in her eyes. "Of course, but I don't want to think about it all the time, Sherry. It's sad." "I know it's sad," I said, "but it's also inspiring. People survived. They resisted. They held on to hope in the darkest of times. I think that's something we can all learn from." Part 2. Ship of Fools. Chapter 8. A Star is Born. Ruby's life was about to pivot. She had approached motherhood with the intensity of an Olympic athlete training for gold, her identity singularly focused on procreation for more than a decade. But now, aged 30, with her sixth and last baby weaned, the Frankie family was finally complete, leaving her with a strange mix of accomplishment and unease, questioning what came next. She needed a fresh outlet for her energy and ambition. Ruby's sisters, Ellie and Bonnie, were already finding success on YouTube as content creators. Ellie's channel, Ellie and Jared, launched in 2011, was particularly thriving. Documenting her struggles with infertility, Ellie's vlog, short for video blog, had built a following of women who saw their own longing reflected in her journey, filling her comment section with messages of support and solidarity, holding their collective breath with each new treatment cycle. When Ellie finally got pregnant after 3 years of trying and posting about it 3 times a week, her vlog hit 1,000 subscribers. In the vlogging world, this was a significant milestone. It meant YouTube started taking her seriously, opening doors for monetization through advertising, sponsorships, and merchandise sales. From there, Ellie's subscriber base had grown exponentially, and with it, her income. Bonnie, the bubbliest of the siblings, had started her own channel in 2013. Married to her high school sweetheart, she followed in Ellie's digital footsteps, crafting content around the universal themes of pregnancy and child-rearing. Her channel, named Bonnie Holine, quickly gained momentum, riding the crest of the family vlogging wave that surged across YouTube between 2012 and 2015. This era marked a seismic shift in social media content. Ordinary people from diverse backgrounds began offering viewers an unfiltered lens into their lives, capturing everything from mundane morning routines to milestone moments. Family vlogs, in particular, struck a chord, transforming kitchen tables and living rooms into stages for a new kind of reality show. The most adept of these digital storytellers found themselves at the helm of a peculiar new industry. They were turning bedtime stories and first steps into ad revenue and sponsorship deals, blurring the lines between intimate family moments and marketable content. It was a brave new world where a camera-ready smile and a knack for wholesome narrative could transmute domestic life into a lucrative enterprise. As Ruby scrolled through her sister's videos, a spark of inspiration ignited. Ellie and Bonnie were becoming vanguards of the family vlogging revolution. But wasn't Ruby the one with the largest brood of all? 6 children, each a character in their own right, a ready-made cast for this new type of reality show? The potential was there, waiting to be tapped. If Ellie and Bonnie could transform the mundane into gold, surely Ruby could craft an empire and prove to the world, and perhaps to herself, that she, Ruby Frankie, was not just a mother, but a matriarch worthy of widespread admiration and emulation. In a moment of clarity, the perfect name for her YouTube channel crystallized in Ruby's mind, 8 Passengers. It was elegant in its simplicity, yet rich with meaning, encapsulating our family's journey, Ruby and Kevin at the helm with their 6 children as a precious cargo. In January 2015, Ruby's vision materialized with the official launch of 8 Passengers on YouTube. The channel would become a stage for our family drama, a curated window into the Frankie household in our everyday lives. Kevin, ever supportive, claimed the honor of being the first subscriber. Ruby was the second. And I, about to turn 12 and caught up in the excitement of this new family venture, eagerly claimed